marketing, explosive growth, and revolutionary secrets that can catapult your business to new heights. You're now listening to the Underground Marketer Podcast with your host, Tudor Dumitrescu, the one podcast devoted to showing new businesses how to market themselves for high growth.
Welcome to the Underground Marketer. This is the place where we deliver the real truth about marketing and explore big ideas that can help new businesses thrive and grow into big ones. I'm your host, Tudor, and today it's my great honor to welcome Dr. John DeMartini, a polymath and one of the world's leading human behavior experts who has been featured in Rhonda Byrne's movie, The Secret, and many other documentaries. Welcome, Dr. John DeMartini.
Well, thank you for having me. Thank you for the opportunity.
That's awesome. So the first question, and I always ask this to my guests, is if you can share with us a little bit about your story and how you got involved in the whole area of personal development and personal transformation. I know you've read over 30,000 books since you're 18. That's a lot of books. It's around, I've calculated it to be around 12 per week. So I think that we all have a lot to learn from you.
I had learning challenges as a child. I was told by my first grade teacher that I would probably never be able to read, write, communicate, never amount to thing, never go very far in life. I made it through elementary school only by asking the smartest kids questions to give me enough information to be able to sort of pass. When I hit 12 going on 13, I moved from Houston, Texas to Richmond, Texas, where I didn't have a bunch of smart kids. We were in a low socioeconomic area, not a lot of bright ones there, and didn't have anybody to ask questions to. I failed and dropped out and became a street kid and picked up surfing, which was a sport that I seemed to have a natural knack for. And that led me to hitchhike out to California when I was 14 and go over to Hawaii when I was 15. Mm-hmm. And I was a surf guy living first under a bridge, then in a park bench, then at a bathroom, and then an abandoned car.
Wow.
I lived as a street kid, but I loved surfing. I almost died at 17 living on the North Shore during a surfing event. And that led me in a recovery of that to a class, which I never went to classes, but this particular individual told me to go to this class. It would help me in the recovery. And one night, 1 hour, one man named Paul C. Bragg really got to me and spoke in such an inspiring manner that it made me feel that maybe I could find a way of overcoming my learning problems and someday become intelligent. I never thought I was going to be. I thought I was going to be surfboard intelligent, but not academically intelligent. And I started on a quest to conquer learning and speaking properly, because I literally had to go to speech pathologist from age 1½. So I wanted to overcome those. I ended up flying back to California, hitchhiking back to Texas, taking a GED, high school equivalency, because mm-hmm. I dropped out of school, guessing and somehow miraculously passing. And then I tried to go to school, back to school, but I failed. And then I almost gave up on the whole idea and thought, well, I guess I'm just going to go back and surf. Mm-hmm. And something my mom said to me after I failed my test, she said, son, whether you become a great teacher and learn or you return to the streets, I just want to let you know your father and I are going to love you no matter what. And in that moment, when she really showed appreciation and love for me, just no matter what I did, I got a determination come over me that I can't describe, except I just made a decision that I was not going to let anything on this earth stop me from learning and learning how to speak properly and then traveling the world teaching. Mm-hmm. So from age 18, when I failed the test, till now, which I'm almost 68, the last 50 years, I started my journey of learning and teaching, and I learned how to read. I started reading dictionaries. I started memorizing words. I started reading encyclopedias. I started reading literally 18 to 20 hours a day, and I got faster and faster and faster and started passing school, and then I ended up excelling, and then I ended up being an honor student and a scholar, and that led me to going to about 10 years of college for my doctorate degree. And I started teaching. I was teaching all the way through, and I never stopped. And I started out with one student, and now I've been blessed to speak in 170 countries around the world. And I keep doing research and writing and traveling and teaching every day. And yeah, I have read a lot of books now. I sometimes read 4 to 7 a day on an average, sometimes up to 18 on a weekend. And I just devoured. I started to learn everything I could in every field I could to try to understand the most I could to help in my teaching process. So here I am. And today I've been doing, between podcasts, I'm researching and writing. And so I can, when I teach, I have something to say. I never stopped. And I overcome my learning problems, and my speaking problems gradually got overcome by just practice.
I see. That's a very inspiring story. I mean, a lot of people deal with hardships, and a lot of people go through such tough experiences. I'd like to investigate that side a bit more. But before that, I just can't wait to ask you this question. How do you manage to read 4 to 7 books in a day? Do you have a special process that you go through? Because I know a lot of people in the entrepreneurship community, all of them are looking at ways to basically learn faster and be able to accumulate a lot more information faster. And if you can share how you do it, I think that would be extremely valuable. For example, one thing that I do with audio content, I always listen to audio content 3 times as fast. You know, I increase the playback speed to the point that I listen to it at 3 times the speed. And that obviously allows me to consume a much larger volume of information than the average person, so to speak.
Well, when I first started to learn how to read, I kept asking myself what worked and what didn't work today. And I would write both of them down. And I started to develop from that feedback more refined skills. And I started experimenting with what helped me learn and what allowed me to absorb. I noticed when I was reading something that I was inspired by, I would be engaged and would not want to put it down. And other times I'd read something that wasn't inspiring and I'd have to keep myself awake. So I started noticing that our values, our individual values, had a play in what we read. So I had to figure out how to link whatever I was reading to what I valued most. I also found that if I ate sugar and I ate anything that caused any volatility of any types of protein, sugars, or fats, I noticed that my reading was declined. And so I started to discipline myself on how I ate. I didn't live to eat. I eat to live and perform. I also noticed that I could snapshot. I started to do photo reading and snapshotting and speed reading and learning how to do faster and faster. So by the time I was around 23, I would get up at 2 a.m. I would do some yoga and stretching and a little meditation. And then I would link whatever books I was about to read to what my mission was, which is the evolvement of human consciousness and teaching. And once I saw the link, I could sit and engage, and I would start off a bit slow, but I would pick up the pace. And by the time I was doing it, it was averaging around 45 minutes of text.
Wow.
A book. And I would read for four hours, and I could do 4, sometimes up to 7 books, depending on the size, by 6:30. And then during the day, if there was, while I was at class, if the teachers were a little bit slow or boring or whatever, I would just read. And then I got to teach the class. I found out that if I taught every night what I learned every morning, it would increase the retention and application and being able to disseminate it. So what I did is I custom designed what I was going to read in advance, put together a talk from that each night. And I'd have 20 to 30 students coming into a single bedroom apartment, cram in there. And I would teach every night. That way I would retain the information and be able to apply it quickly. Mm-hmm. And that accelerated my learning process. So I learned the sooner you give out what you learn, the more retention. So I started to speed read books and disseminate information, speed read books. I do a talk from 7 p.m. to 10 p.m. every night. And then I'd go to bed for 4 hours and I'd get up at 2 and start the process again. I was kind of like a machine for many years. People thought I was kind of a weirdo, but I didn't care. I just wanted to learn and I wanted to practice speaking. So this accelerated my learning capacities, and I studied many disciplines, 300 different disciplines now. And so I could have a more universal base of knowledge that I could rely on. So that's anything to do with evolving human consciousness, anything to do with maximizing human awareness potential, anything with any field that might relate to that. I mean, I don't know of any field that's not related to that, really. So I've been devouring it to try to assist people in doing something extraordinary with their life. I really believe that we're here to do something extraordinary.
Absolutely. I mean, can you share a bit about or provide some tips about your process to speed read? Do you skip some words? Do you try to read visually? What exactly are the techniques that you find most helpful?
Well, there was many of them I learned along the way as I found out. I kept asking what worked and what didn't work. I found out that without a visual guide, our eyes tend to wander. We have what is called saccadic movements in our eyes, which are little bitty jerky movements all the time. And unless we have a visual guide, it's probable that they will migrate and move around. So I used visual guides. At first, I used my finger, and then I started using a pencil. And then I started to use that as a guide to make sure that my eyes are focused. Because if you try to move your eyes fluently and smoothly across the page, your eyes will be going all over the place. But if you have a visual guide, you can guide it. So that was one thing to help me stay focused. I also realized that if I was infatuated or resentful and I had any subjective bias towards the author, it would skew the information coming in the brain. And so I neutralized my perception of the author and I linked whatever I was reading to what was most valuable to me by asking, how is this helping me fulfill what's most meaningful and important, my mission? And I would answer that until I would get a tear of gratitude. And then I would absorb, because my focal fixation point would expand, my retention and application and attention would heighten. Whenever it's linked to what we value most, it automatically does that. So I just started picking up bits and pieces along the way. And I started to get to a point where I could literally, the most I ever read was 11,000 pages in a day. That was a day that I just tested my capacity to see what I could do. So I went literally in a 24-hour period, 11,000 pages. I didn't know if I could do it. I had no idea. I just kept doing it. And the faster I got and the more I got into it, the more visual it became in reading. Mm-hmm. And once you break the sound barrier and get into visual reading, you can absorb pages literally in a picture. And I was studying cancer at the time because I was about to do a presentation on oncology to 1,000 oncologists. And so I wanted to make sure I knew my stuff before I got there. So I made a commitment to read every book that was available in Houston, Texas on cancer before I got to that stage. Mm-hmm. And I did. But that was a deadline. So giving yourself deadlines and giving yourself a purpose for the information and giving yourself some accountability on what you're going to do with the information will awaken an autographic and photographic memory in people that they didn't even know they had. I slowly but surely accumulated knowledge about how to absorb information, and that allowed me to absorb and read many, many books.
That's fantastic. I want to thank you, by the way, for what you're doing. I think that it's extremely valuable. And all the knowledge that you're gathering and synthesizing and sharing with people. I actually love interviewing polymaths. I've also interviewed, I don't know if you know him, Ofer Breyer. He's read 17,000 books. You've read almost double that. So it's fascinating to hear both perspectives. He actually has a fascinating process of reading himself. He started reading very slowly, but asking questions and drawing inferences about the topic. And then if he found something that he already knew, he would just skip it. So the reading progressively got faster and faster and faster the more he read. But anyway, all of these learning systems are very fascinating to me and very important for everybody who is an entrepreneur.
Sometimes when you read a book, you see patterns in the book. Some people will bold and italicize important points. And if you find out you read a whole chapter and you found out that they summarized it in these bold and italicized things, you can speed read just by efficient reading, by reading what the highlights are, the most important parts. There's also book summaries you can buy. That is a form of speed reading too. I mean, you can go and people have already read and summarized the entire book and taken extracted the most important part. So some people just buy book summaries and devour the book that way. These are not really speed reading, but they're just, in a sense, a speed learning process because you're cutting out the unnecessary data. But I'm a firm believer in doing both. Use every tool you can to absorb the information you want. You want to have specialized knowledge in the field of your expertise if you want to lead the field.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I mean, with regards to summaries, I find out that sometimes they do get the main points right, but a lot of the detail, which is valuable, especially if you want to be able to think further ahead than the author, is left out. You know, so you're better off speed reading the actual work from that point of view.
Yes, you need to find out who's doing the summaries and make sure that they're really extracting something that you're looking for. Mm-hmm. If not, that summary is not the book. Mm-hmm. And then you just speed read it. Mm-hmm. So I agree totally.
Awesome. You talk a lot about purpose and value and mission. And obviously, you're somebody who is pretty much led by your mission and you live your mission every day of your life. So can you tell us a little bit more about how that first started? Was it something that was all of a sudden you just decided and then that decision stayed firm throughout your history? Or is it something that formed gradually, so to speak?
1972, November 18th, is the night I met Paul Bragg. Mm-hmm. And he inspired us. His presentation was absolutely amazing. And it inspired me to... I didn't even know what a purpose or a mission was until then. I didn't even comprehend what the word was at the time. But he's the one that initiated that idea. And I wrote my first mission statement then. Mm-hmm. And I learned a question, very thing, and I hope everybody writes this down. And that is to start with what you know and let what you know grow. Mm-hmm. Start what you're certain about. So I wrote down that I knew that I wanted to travel the world. I started traveling when I was 3 around the neighborhood. By the time I was 9, I was riding bicycles 35 miles. Mm-hmm. By the time I was 12, I was hopping trains to different cities. By the time I was 13, I was hitchhiking to different cities. When I was 14, I hitchhiked across America and down into Mexico to Central America. 15, I moved to Hawaii.
Whoa.
I mean, I have traveled 20 million miles by airlines, 20 million. And I live on a ship that circumnavigates Earth. Right now, I'm on the way to Ecuador, and so I'm sailing right now.
Wow.
And I am traveling nonstop. I circumnavigate the world in all different capacities. So I knew I wanted to travel. So I wrote down I wanted to travel the world and step foot on every country on the face of the earth. I knew I wanted to overcome my learning problems and become knowledgeable. I knew I wanted to be able to overcome my speaking problems and be able to teach and become intelligent enough to say something. So I wrote those things down, and they were very clear in my mind. And what he mentioned was these principles of the universe, the laws of the universe or natural laws. And I said, I want to know what those are, whatever those are. I want to know what those are. And I want to dedicate my life to the application of those in human behavior, even though I didn't use exactly those words, but to assist it, because I wanted to do what he did for me. Mm-hmm. He inspired me. I wanted to inspire other people. So I wrote down that and started with that. And then my mission statement has been edited 80 times in 49 and a half years. Mm-hmm. 80 times in 49 and a half years. I have every one of those edited versions. I still have it. I have the master, as of this year, the master mission statement right now, where it is now, but it's the 80th rendition. So I have read it and refined it. And every time I read it, which is a daily thing, I will refine it if I need to add a word or put in a little phrase or add a statement or change a word or whatever. I read it and refine it. And if it doesn't bring me tears of inspiration when I read it, I refine it until it does.
Mm-hmm.
And I want it to be so deeply inspiring and meaningful to me that it's a statement about my life. And I learned that a human being has a set of values, a set of priorities they live their life by. And whenever they're doing something that's congruent and aligned with their highest value, that's when they're most engaged, inspired, and spontaneously active and achieving our end. So the highest value is the path of a mission. It is the purpose. It's the direction. In fact, our ontological identity revolves around our highest value. Our epistemological learning pathway revolves around our highest value. And our teleological purpose revolves around our highest value. And knowing what that is why I have on my website a value determination process to help people freely and privately go through a process to help them define what it is. Because the second they can structure their life and prioritize their life and delegate lower priority things to get on with doing the highest priority things, they're going to all of a sudden start to maximize their potential and do something more extraordinary.
Mm-hmm. That's fascinating. So we will definitely have a link to that down in the show notes so that our listeners can access it. And I wanted to ask you, how do you discover your highest value? But now, obviously, that's the answer. It seems to me like Paul Bragg had a huge influence upon your life. And I mean, the way you describe it, that really was a turning point for you. Do you remember what exactly was it about what he said that day or evening, perhaps, I don't know what it was, that made such an impact on you?
Well, he said that we had a body, we had a mind, and we had a soul. That was his language.
Mm-hmm.
And the body must be directed by the mind, and the mind must be guided by the soul. Now, the soul is simply the authentic self within. That's just a theological term, but that just means the real authentic you. And he said that we want to set goals for ourselves, our family, our community, our city, our state, our nation, our world, and beyond to 100, 120 years. Because he said, by then, when you're that age, people are going to be living to 100 years. And he said that what you think about, what you visualize, what you affirm, what you feel about, what you take actions on, becomes your destiny.
Mm-hmm.
And whatever is most important to you determines what you will automatically spontaneously think about and visualize, etc. So that's what led me to the values. And I've been studying and teaching about values for 44 years and probably read everything that's been ever put together on that, and at least in English. And I've summarized it, and I've got a value determination process, which is cuts through the grease and gets out of the subjection to outer authority mentality and gets you into the core essence of what really drives a human being, because your life demonstrates your values by your actions. So what I do is I look at how people fill their space. I look at how they spend their time. I look at what energizes them. I look at what they spend their money on. I look at what they think about, visualize, an internal dialogue with themselves about how they want their life that shows evidence of coming true. I look at what they converse and try to bring conversation to spontaneously. I look at what inspires them and brings tears to their eyes and what's common to the people who inspire them. I look at what their most consistent, persistent goals have been that they're achieving. I look at what they love learning about, studying about spontaneously and watching on YouTube. And there's a pattern when you answer those questions, those 13 questions, there's a pattern that smacks you in the face about what's really important to you. And it doesn't always match the fantasies you might be holding on to. And getting past the fantasies and getting to the core essence of what drives you is a real powerful thing for entrepreneurs, because that's where they're not going to let themselves down. That's not where they're going to end up feeling defeated. That's not where they're going to end up going through vacillation. That's where they're going to be steady, and they're going to expand their space and time horizons and see vision of opportunity.
Mm-hmm. I mean, how exactly do you do that? How do you get past the fantasies? I mean, a lot of entrepreneurs, they dream of riches perhaps, or they dream of big impacts upon the world, but they still struggle with the practical aspects of business, actually going out there and doing it. You know, they deal with issues like anxiety, fears, procrastination. What is your advice when it comes to dealing with
such issues? It's very simple. It's so simple, people overlook it. I remember Charlie Munger saying, the truth is so simple that people are afraid to face the truth. It's so simple. And that is that when you live congruently, according to what you truly value, you're disciplined, reliable, and focused. But if you don't know what that is, and you try to be somebody you're not, and try to live by what is injected values because you're comparing yourself to other people you put on pedestals and fantasizing about being them instead of you, and lose your authenticity, you automatically will be in an unfulfilled lower value structure. Mm-hmm. And anytime you do, you'll procrastinate, hesitate, and frustrate. So procrastination, hesitation, and frustration is a spontaneous feedback to let you know you're pursuing something that's not truly important to you, even though you fantasize it is. And anytime you do that and you're living in lower values, your blood glucose and oxygen goes into the amygdala, and the amygdala is avoiding pain and seeking pleasure. So you now set up fantasies of getting pleasure without pain, ease without difficulty, money without work. And you set up a fantasy of a quick get rich scheme and a quick get rich mentality. And this is not what leads to great account outcomes. It's long-term vision that gives you persistence. And so anytime you're not living by your highest values, you go down in the amygdala, you're going to create the phobias. Because you're going to set up a fantasy of trying to get a pleasure without a pain and trying to avoid a pain without a pleasure. And anytime you do that, you fear the loss of your fantasy and you fear the gain of your nightmare. And you're now entrenched in fear instead of focus. And that's what stops people. They set up a fantasy about what they're going after instead of getting clear on what is really, truly meaningful and their real objective. And a lot of them have fantasies. And, you know, I was in South Africa, and I was speaking to about 5,000 people there. Mm-hmm. And I was doing a program with Richard Branson there. And there was a 5,000 people, and I asked, how many of you would love to be financially independent? Every hand went up, even their arms and legs stick up in the air. And I said, great. I said, how many of you are financially independent? All the hands went down except seven out of 5,000.
Wow. Yeah.
And this was just a general audience. Yeah. It wasn't like just entrepreneur executives. It was general audience. And I said, okay, now, would you like to know why you're not with those seven? Of course, they want to know why. And I said, let me explain. I'm going to give you $10 million right now. And on a piece of paper, I want you to write down what you would do if you received $10 million. You got 60 seconds to write down the 10 things you would do with $10 million. I said, on your mark, get set, go. And they wrote down rapidly as they could the 10 things they would do with that money. When I got through at the end of 60 seconds, I said, now turn it to the friend and calculate how much of that money is still now an asset that's usable to invest. And 20 to 80% of it was gone. Mm-hmm. That means they bought consumables that depreciate. They bought a car, they bought a house, they bought depreciables and consumables, fancy clothes, fancy trips, fancy boats, this and that. Everything that would go down in value that would be a liability, not an asset. And the few people that wrote down assets, they put it and invested in assets, were a handful of people, less than 1%. So most people don't know that. They live in the fantasy of lifestyles of the rich and famous, and they think that they're going to get there by buying consumables because they're not building a brand that's empowering themselves. They're trying to live vicariously through other people's brands to feel better about themselves because they're unfulfilled pursuing fantasies. Mm-hmm. And as a result of it, they get trapped in an economic vicious cycle instead of a virtuous cycle of slow, steady, methodical, patient, enduring asset accumulation, net buyers of assets. that's what accumulates and builds wealth.
Where do you think the fantasies are coming from? Do you think that they are internally generated? Do you think that they're put there by society and we take them on unconsciously? What exactly do you think is the mechanism there?
Both. Anytime you're not living by your highest value and awakening the executive center, every time you live by your highest value, the blood glucose and oxygen goes into the medial prefrontal cortex, the executive center, and activates inspired vision, strategic planning, executing plans, a mitigation of risks, and a calming and dampening of the distractions of the amygdala. And anytime you're not living by highest values, your amygdala comes alive. And the amygdala just wants to avoid predator and seek prey, wants to go after pleasure without pain. And so it sets up fantasies. And so anytime we meet somebody and we put them on a pedestal, we think they're smarter than us, more successful than us, more wealthy than us, more stable in their relationships, and more socially savvy than us, more physically fit, more spiritually aware. And we minimize ourselves and we're too humble to admit what we see in them inside us. We're automatically going to be trying to live in their world, inject their values, and cloud the clarity of our own mission, which is our highest value. And the moment we do, that unfulfillment puts us in the amygdala and we compound it now with fantasies of trying to be somebody we're not. And this is a symptom to let us know we're not being authentic. In fact, every symptom in the entrepreneurial pathway in your business is a feedback to you to get authentic. Because when you're authentic, you're objective, you're in sustainable fair exchange with other people because you have equanimity within you and equity between you and other people. And this is the powerful state to actually become the entrepreneur in. But this is not going to happen if you're trying to be somebody you're not and living in lower values.
I think based on what you're saying here, that self-awareness really is at the heart of this process for personal growth as an entrepreneur. And I find that typically with entrepreneurs, their business is no bigger than they are as people. Personal growth, so to speak, goes hand in hand with the growth of the business. As the leader is, so is the rest of the business. It really reflects the leader. How do you think people can go about developing this kind of self-awareness that allows them to basically see through their limiting beliefs and through the things that are holding them back, through the fantasy, as you call it, and basically move ahead towards their highest value?
Limiting beliefs are nothing more than the inculcation and injection of outer people's values and attempting to live in an inauthentic way in other people's values. Anytime you try to live in other people's values, you have futility and you have feedback to let you know that doesn't work. And you're going to think, oh, my, if you hold on to them and you got addiction to the fantasy, you're going to think it's a limited belief. But limited belief is a feedback system guiding you to authenticity. And so that's one. But anytime you are doing what's really highest on your values, you automatically are more objective and you're willing to embrace pain and pleasure in the pursuit of things because you can embrace both sides of life. And your awareness level is maximized because you learn most. The pulmonary nuclear in your thalamus automatically filters out all of your sensory information and extracts out things that are most aligned to what you value most. So you're going to maximize your awareness and potential. That's why I link everything I learned to my highest value. And that allows me to have a photographic memory on that information. As a result of that, you're going to maximize your awareness. You're going to maximize your willingness to embrace pain and pleasure in the pursuit of it. You're going to be more objective. You're going to increase the probability of achievement. And every time you achieve something, you tend to give yourself permission to go on to a greater achievement. So the space and time horizons will grow until eventually the space and time horizons are beyond your life. And you're on your way to make an immortal legacy, creating something that goes beyond your life, even a philanthropic objective. So this is what happens when you live congruently. I think we're rewarded by the friggin' universe in all areas of our life by living authentically. This is why everybody wants to be loved and appreciated for who they truly are instead of the facades that they make out of their life.
That's very powerful. I wanted to ask you, what is your opinion on mindfulness or meditation in this process of self-development and self-awareness and growth?
Well, I think that if meditation, I started meditating the night I met Paul Bragg, and I studied most of the forms of meditation I've seen in the Western world. I think that that's a very powerful use, but I see so many people escaping with meditation. It's distressful. I want to escape it. And instead of actually going in and finding out how whatever's happening is on the way, they're trying to escape it. And I don't find that productive. So meditation, if it's used wisely, is going to integrate information instead of avoid part of the information. So there's a difference. So don't use it to escape. Use it to integrate information by asking inside, how is whatever I'm perceiving, how is it offering me a feedback to authenticity? How is it helping me fulfill my highest mission? If you do that, you'll see life on the way, not in the way. You won't have any baggage, because anything you can't say thank you for in your life is baggage. Anything you can say thank you for is fuel. The executive center is also called the gratitude center in neurology. We automatically have a grace state, a graceful movement state when we're living congruently. In fact, grace movement comes from grace mentally. And grace is a state of gratitude, or mercy, as they say in French. So for the moment we actually see that no matter what's happening, it's a feedback mechanism instead of a failure. So we hold on to a fantasy with the amygdala. We're going to think if it doesn't match the fantasy, we got a failure, and then we're going to beat ourselves up. But if we actually see that no matter what's going on, it's simply a refinement and feedback. I asked, what is it? What worked? What didn't work on reading? I didn't call what I read. If I didn't read a fast, I didn't call it a failure. I just said, how is it a feedback? And when you see life as a feedback system, it refines you to do something ever greater on a daily basis.
I was asking you because meditation is very popular nowadays amongst entrepreneurs. But most people, you know, most of the time when people learn meditation, they're told that they have to be in the moment. And if they notice any thought that comes up in their mind, they have to let it go and basically get rid of thoughts. Do you think that that is helpful, or do you think that that generally tends to be bypassing and avoiding the issues?
I think that's an early stage of meditation. Newcomers that are just starting meditation, that's at least a starting point. I analyzed meditation with Buddhist monks and stuff, and I found something really interesting. The very content of your mind that you're trying to bypass is nothing more than lopsided perceptions where you've divided your conscious and unconscious awareness. So in other words, if you're infatuated with somebody, you're conscious of the upsides and unconscious of the downsides. If you're resentful to somebody, you're conscious of the downsides, unconscious of the upsides. But if you're infatuated, we've all been infatuated, and whatever we're infatuated with occupies space and time in our mind and consumes our mind. And whatever we're resentful to consumes our mind. So anything we have a lopsided perception, we've got a division in our conscious and unconscious halves of awareness, and we've got a sub-threshold and super-threshold neurological state. We have noise in the brain, and our signal-to-noise ratio is altered. And that's our distractions, and that's all the noise that comes in when we're doing our meditation. Once you know what that noise is, there's a science. I developed a method on how to dissolve that noise so the signal ratio can come pouring through, and you can be inspired by your life. So I think meditation by itself is slow and cumbersome, but meditation with the right questions inside the mind and the right perspective is powerful. And so I'm for it. And that's what brings mindfulness. Your intuition is constantly trying to make you conscious of the unconscious to make you fully conscious. And if you know how to ask the right questions and strengthen the intuition, you can actually become mindful, which means conscious of both sides at the same time. That's called objectivity. It's called equanimity. It's called superconsciousness or cosmic consciousness. It's got a thousand names by greatest philosophers and thinkers through the ages. But accessing that state is a science. You can train on it. You can learn it. I teach people that every week. And it's an amazing way of opening up the doorways for an inspired life from within instead of being pulled around from all kinds of vicissitudes from the external world. Most people, I said on The Secret, when the voice and the vision on the inside is louder than all opinions on the outside, you begin to master your game of life.
This is fascinating because, I mean, this division in the self that you speak about now, that mindfulness, when done well, is going to cure, this sort of ties into what you were saying about pursuing your highest value. Because when you do pursue your highest value, then you are whole. You know, there is no division inside.
You're integrated.
Yeah, exactly.
The brain is automatically at the most primitive level at the monosynaptic reflex is all or none. It either fires at a threshold or it doesn't. But as you go up in the brain, you get what they call spatial and temporal summation, and you get gradual integration. So the more balanced you are in your perceptions and not fooled subjectively with your bias, the more you integrate the brain and the more you see things both-sided. All leaders have to be able to manage paradoxes, and paradoxes are contrary opinions. And these are pairs of opposites. The master lives in a world of the synthesis and synchronicity of pairs of opposites. And when they do, they don't have to fear the loss of that which they seek or fear the gain of that which they're trying to avoid. They're present. And that all memory and imagination are separations in time because of all the noise we've got in our brain, storing all those illusions until we're ready for truth. The moment we awaken to the center of that, the integration of that, the synthesis of that, we have, in a sense, the real simultaneous contrast of opposites. Now we can manage life and lead the path.
Very interesting. Do you think that ontologically speaking, the state of what Buddhists call enlightenment exists?
I think that there's no such thing as a human that's fully enlightened It's a relative term. When you stop and think about it, imagine a little human being sitting in a lotus position, a little yogi sitting in some tree, under a tree, going around the earth, 86,400 seconds to one revolution. And they go around there and they think, well, I'm enlightened. And then they imagine now to the sun, 93 million miles, an astronomical unit from the sun looking at the earth. You can't see it without a telescope. Mm-hmm. So it's an insignificant dot. And so that yogi, who's an insignificant little speck on top of that dot, who thinks they're all enlightened, it needs to stop and reflect and think maybe they're just only enlightened to the level of what they know. Mm-hmm. So I always say that from the center of the Milky Way, looking at the sun, we can't even discern our own solar system. So anytime somebody thinks they're all enlightened, I usually just go, mm-hmm. But I think we need to live in holy curiosity and keep expanding our awareness on a daily basis, because whatever we know, there's always a mystery that's beyond it, that's more infinite. And so relative enlightenment, we have a relative awareness compared to what somebody else has, or maybe compared to what we had yesterday, but we're not fully enlightened. The idea of a full enlightenment is a bit of a mismatch.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's interesting. So what would you say the mystery for you now is at the stage that you're at?
Oh, I'm constantly at the edge of learning as much as I can, and I'm constantly in mysteries. I had a nice debate with a Yale professor this morning on free will and predestination, and also on neurology. So I'm learning every day. I'm constantly learning. I'm looking at right now on the genetic and epigenetic effects of regression in states of mind and how it affects cells and cancer creation. I'm constantly looking at whatever I'm interested in and taking it to the next level. I want to read every single day and learn something new every day and hopefully be able to contribute in some way. I've said since I was 20 years old, I said I create original ideas that serve humanity. That's been my internal dialogue. And I'm a firm believer that if we go in and dig and we can learn and come to the cutting edge of things and actually come up with original ideas that contribute. So that's my goal, is to constantly see what I can do at the frontiers of awareness, come up with something that's contributed, that's original, and make some sort of contribution.
I see. Thank you for doing that, Dr. DeMartini. I know that you've taken part in the documentary, The Secret. A lot of people have watched that. A lot of people are interested, especially in the business world, in the law of attraction. You also have similar books in the business world, like Napoleon Hill's Think and Grow Rich, for example, or The Science of Getting Rich by Wallace. There's a bunch of books like that. Can you tell us a little bit about your experience doing The Secret, what you think about The Secret, and what you think about the law of attraction and how it can be useful to entrepreneurs?
Well, the movie came out before the book, and the movie went through a few gyrations. Originally, there was only 6 people in the movie, mm-hmm. and I happened to be one of them, and they actually were advertising it in Melbourne, Australia, at a Channel 9 there. It was going to launch there, and it was then going to go around the world at different points. And then they found the Commonwealth Games bought out the time and overrid them, and so they end up going into DVD, DaVita's DVD system, and launched it globally that spring of that year, 2006, I think. And so originally, it was not with 33 people. It was just 6 people. And it was a more in-depth exploration about the ancient mysteries of The Secret, right, about mastery of life. It was a completely different version of what it ended up being. But what happened is that they realized if they're going to go mass market with this, they're going to have to dilute it down and water it down a bit. And when they did that, they tried to get as many of the people in there as possible, because they knew that those individuals would help market it. And in the process of doing it, they kind of made it a little watered down version. And they left out very important components called taking action. Mm-hmm. But it still reached millions of people, and it still made a difference in people's lives. And it opened up doorways for each of us to contribute even more. I mean, I was already speaking 360 times a year, but it went up to over 400 after that. So in the process of doing that, I'm grateful for that. It was a watered down version. I mean, the law of attraction, it was almost turned into some sort of esoteric mechanism instead of something practical. But originally, it was more practical. And I'm a firm believer that if you live by your highest values, you increase the probability of synchronicities, you increase the probability of seeing opportunities, and you increase the opportunity of doing them and taking actions on them. So you have a higher level of achievement. But many times people have fantasies, they're deluded. I had many, I'm talking about thousands of people come up to me and said, what am I doing wrong? Mm-hmm. I'm going out to my mailbox every day and I'm looking for $1 million check and it just doesn't show up. I mean, these are delusions. You might get get $1 million check in there from some uncle that you didn't know about. But the reality is, this is not how to make the law of attraction work. The law of attraction is if doing something that's truly high in your values that you're committed to doing and increasing the probability of achieving it by taking actions and focusing on it and thinking about it and visualizing it and asking and learning and growing in that direction. Mm-hmm. That's the real true manifestation, mm-hmm. not the fantasy world. And many people took it out of context and saw it as a fantasy.
That's very interesting. I mean, it's easier to see it as a fantasy, right? You don't have to do any work and whatever you want just comes to you by itself. It's much easier to see it that way. And of course, it's also much easier to sell it to people that way. But I'm also a firm believer in what I call realistic thinking. You know, some people, they say that you have to think positively. Personally, I don't necessarily share that because, you know, every moment you're thinking positively, the positive thought has an opposite, which is hiding somewhere there. And sooner or later, it's going to come out. If I think that XYZ is positive, then the opposite is will by necessity be negative. So it's much better to be both realistic and face what's actually there in front of you.
Exactly. That the Stoics understood this. And what people do, when you're in your amygdala, you tend to have a subjective bias, a confirmation and a disconfirmation bias, a false positive and a false negative. And you're basically skewing your reality and living in a delusion. And while you're infatuated with your fantasy, you're blind to the downside. And while when the nightmares come, which are inevitable, they're actually there, but you don't see them. And then when they become consciously aware, then you're blind to the upsides. Mm-hmm. And so I'm not a positive thinker by any means. I think that's hokey and it's basically misleading people. It's an opium of the masses. I'm a balanced thinker. And if you don't see both sides, you're not going to have mindfulness. Mm-hmm. Mindfulness is seeing both sides simultaneously.
Absolutely.
The illusion of one side is an opium for the mass market. And that's why I don't promote success or failure mentality. I think success is a depurposing state to pursue and failure is a repurposing state. And they're both feedback mechanisms for a man on a mission.
They're both valuable.
I'm a firm believer of being mm-hmm. a man. I'm interested in being on a mission, not interested about success. I don't give a damn about the term success. Even Keo from Coca-Cola Company says, I'm leery about people that think they're successful. They're on their way down.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I absolutely share with that. I mean, I think very much in a similar way. So it's fascinating. You mentioned the Stoics. Do you have a particular favorite philosopher in history?
Well, no, I've studied thousands of. I just finished last year in November a textbook, actually October, a textbook on a lot of philosophers, Western, Eastern, Asian, you name it, and scientists. So anybody that's made a contribution in history, I try to devour them. Mm-hmm. So I go all the way back to Thales and Ames from Egypt and Eminem Opt. I go through all of them, all the way the Greek philosophers from Pythagoras and Thales and Anaximander, Anaximenes, Anaxagoras, Philolaus. I go through Aristarchus, Plato, Socrates. You know, I've gone through all of Theophrastus. I've gone through every possible philosopher there is that I'm aware of. And I devour their writings and summarize their writings and take the best principles I can and incorporate it. You know, Heraclitus and these guys, Parmenides, all these guys had something to contribute on the planet. And I'm a firm believer that some of those contributions are still active today and usable today.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Related to this, I wanted to ask you, and this is a question that I ask of every guest, but I think it's very important for you because you've just read so much. What would you say your top five book recommendations, if you had to make any, would be? And I realize that may be a very hard question, just given the amount that you've read.
Well, I tell people, when people ask me, you know, what's the best book to buy? I tell them to get Syntopicon Volumes 1 and 2 by the Britannica series from The Great Ideas. Mm-hmm. Syntopicon, Syntopicon, Volumes 1 and 2. And what that is the greatest ideas by the greatest minds in the Western world in the last 2,700 years summarized into the most important topics. That's why it's called Syntopicon. It's a synthesis of the greatest, most important topics that human beings have thought about that we could discuss and look at and learn about. And it's a PhD on life. And those two books, I think, are just two essential books for people who want to master their life. Those are just a good starting point. Those two books.
Mm-hmm.
That's the size of about five books.
Yeah,
those two books.
I know them. They're about 1,000 pages each, I think. So
yep, they're that just about that big.
Yeah, yeah, they're definitely quite thick. Thank you for that recommendation. I mean, I think that it's definitely worth the effort going through them because just the breadth of knowledge that you're going to get is going to be supremely useful. And actually, when it comes to entrepreneurs, a lot of people don't understand. I mean, they want knowledge to be immediately useful to them, right? And they don't understand the value that somebody gets out of having a very broad understanding of things that are out there. But I mean, if we look at people like Elon Musk, who are very successful, they're not just good at one thing. They have a very large breadth of understanding about the human world and where we're at today in the progress of society. So what is your advice with regards to that?
Well, you can know more and more about less and less and become a specialist and over-specialize and put yourself into extinction if you're not able to adapt to a changing environment. Or you can learn less and less about more and more and also have more adaptation and find the common threads to all those disciplines and find the most universal principles that way. I personally think it's wise to start with a specialty and branch out and become polymathic. When I look at the people that I've stood on the shoulders of, most of them are polymaths. Mm-hmm. The people that have made the biggest marks in the world were those people that started in one specialty, broadened it out, and hit it from so many lateral angles, from so many different ways of looking at it, that they were able to pioneer new ideas. So I'm a firm believer of that. Or to surround yourself with those people around you so you can allow yourself to glean insights by having great minds around you. Either way, those two can help. I try to surround myself with some of the great minds. I've met thousands of people that are bright people on this planet. And I try to do that and have debates with them. I do it almost every morning with very bright people. And I find that that helps me go back and learn new words and new things and tackle and be objective with myself and do self-reflection and make sure I'm not deluding myself sometimes. So those are essential.
This is fascinating. I feel that you have so much to teach, Dr. Demartini, and we're struggling to cover all of it, you know, in one short episode. Can you share a little bit about how people can find out more about you and what next steps they should take if they want to discover more about themselves and basically discover their highest values and pursue them?
Well, I don't want to ever put a should on them. I don't want anybody to have to feel that they've got to, have to, must, should, ought to, supposed to, or need to from anything I say. I want them to find intrinsically what inspires them and let them decide in their own life their path. I'm a firm believer of that. But if they would like to learn about what I'm doing, they can go to my website, drdemartini.com. If they'd like to go and have a real great beginning insight about their own values and look at what's true in their life, the value determination process on that website is free. It's private. And I would do it once and do it a week later and do it a month later until you're honest with yourself. When you get a tear of gratitude and you're really honest, it'll be a valuable piece of information to be known. And then they can go on my website and they can take advantage of the thousands of interviews, the radio, the television, the movies. There's just YouTubes. There's the podcast, the Demartini Show. And there's also the Breakthrough Experience, which is my signature program that I've been doing for 33 years. I've done it 1,144 times around the world. And I'm absolutely certain that if anybody wants to go down the path of mastery, authenticity, and empowerment, that course is going to blow their mind on what they're going to learn in 2 days. That I'm certain about. I ask people every week when I do that course, how many of you learned something this weekend that you could have gone your whole life and never have learned if you hadn't been here? Every hand goes up week after week after week.
That's fascinating.
If they want to save some time and not have to go and read 30,000 books and not have to go and, you know, they can stand on my shoulder. I love it. This is what I enjoy doing most. This is my life, is researching, writing, and teaching.
That's fascinating. Can you tell our listeners a bit more about what they can expect if they actually attend the event, the Breakthrough Experience?
Well, we're going to find out what they think is in their way, and we're going to find out how it's on the way. I'm going to show them how to determine their values and get really clear about what it is. I'm going to show them how to prioritize their life and delegate their lives. So, because if you're not delegating lower priority things, you're going to be trapped. Anytime you do something low on your values, you're going to devalue yourself. And that's not what your greatest potential is. And anytime you're doing the absolute number one thing, as Gary Keller says, that one thing, and liberate yourself to do that, that's where your genius is going to be born. Because that's where you're going to be pursuing challenges that inspire you instead of filling your life with challenges that don't. That's where you're going to end up having mastery. Then I'm going to teach you the Demartini method, which is on how to dissolve any baggage that's sitting there. Because a lot of people are carrying around distractions from past memories that are infatuations or resentments, phobias and philias, prides and shames and griefs and all this other stuff. I'm going to show you how to take any emotion that is distracting you and show you how to neutralize it. And it's a science. I guarantee it. you apply, we're going to do it. We're going to demonstrate it, make you do it, and you're going to experience it. So I hold you accountable. Mm-hmm. It's a highly accountable workshop. It's not a rah-rah. It's not standing on shoulders. It's not for people that want to spectate. It's for people that want to master their life. I show you even how to own the traits, the greats. See, I always say that in the true you, nothing's missing. In the false you, you have these assumptions there's something missing, things you're too proud or too humble to admit that you have, that you see in others. But the moment you realize nothing's missing, you're both hero and villain and saint and sinner and virtue and vice, you're all the above, and you give yourself permission to be all the above, you're on your way. You can't try to get rid of half of yourself. Don't expect to ever master your life and love yourself if you're trying to get rid of half of yourself with moral hypocrisies. You got to be able to own it all inside you if you want to master the game, because otherwise you're going to be stopped at the level of what you're trying to avoid in your lives. So this program is a very practical, very experiential thing that allows people to get on the way, see life on the way, not in the way. So if you think you came in there with baggage, there's no victim of history in this course. It's only master of destiny. That's all I'm going to, anybody tries to pull off a victim game, I'm just going to squash it.
Thank you very much for sharing that and for giving our listeners that opportunity. You mentioned earlier that you want people to be intrinsically motivated and inspired. However, very frequently, this requires some degree of self-trust. And many people I've noticed, they just don't have this capacity to trust themselves. They always trust people outside of themselves. So how can people go about changing that?
Okay. The trust factor, the oxytocin and vasopressin transmitters are only activated when you're doing something that is high in your value. It goes back to values. Because the only thing you can rely on anybody to do is do whatever they think in any moment that'll help them fulfill what they value most. Every decision they make, every perception they take, every action they take is always based on what they value most. So when you basically have an expectation to try to do something that's not really highest on your values that you've inculcated from the outside world, from some outside authority that you're envying, you're automatically not going to trust yourself. And you're designed not to trust yourself until you're authentic. Mm-hmm. It's designed that way. It's not a flaw. It's not a weakness. It is an absolute biological homeostatic feedback mechanism guiding you to only pursue what's truly authentic and meaningful to you. And that's designed that way. So many people think they're flawed and they think they're messed up, but they're not. Once they identify what they really value and get prioritized on that, that's immediately transformed.
Mm-hmm. This is all super fascinating and highly valuable for our listeners. So thank you for coming on the show. I wanted to give you the opportunity, if you have anything else that you would like to leave our listeners with now that we're approaching the end, any comments that you would like to make or share with them.
Yeah, if you want to make a difference in yourself, it's essential that you have a vision as big as your family. If you want to make a difference in your family, be a leader in your family, you need a vision as big as your community. You want to be number one in your community, you want a vision as big as your city. You want to be number one in the city, you need a vision as big as your state or province or prefect. And if you want to be number one in your state, you need a national vision. You want to be number one in the nation, you need a global vision. If you want to make a global difference, it's time for an astronomical vision. And the astronomical vision only occurs when the space and time horizons keep expanding by living congruently by what you value most. Because that's where you give yourself permission to shine like a star instead of shrink down on the terrestrial world where you're judging. We're here to love or we're here to judge. If we're trapped in our judgments, we're not going to empower life because we're going to be trying to change ourselves relative to others or others relative to ourselves, which is futile. But if we actually were able to share the thing that we would really love in this planet with the people that we'd love to do it with, and have some equanimity, man, the sky's the limit. And I'm a firm believer in giving yourself permission to shine, not shrink.
Mm-hmm. Thank you then very much, Dr. DeMartini, for coming on the show. You're very inspiring and I'm very moved by your mission and your dedication to the mission, which is obvious and evident to anyone listening. Thank you once again for coming on the show. And to our listeners, stay tuned for the next episode, and until next time, remember, keep growing your businesses and providing massive value to the world. You are the reason why we're all growing richer, our freedoms are expanding, and we're all living in greater prosperity. Thank you.
Thank you.